some months before you got wind of a possible coup plans, in spring of 1953, Mossadegh wrote to President Eisenhower requesting U.S. financial assistance. And Eisenhower turned the request down, saying that there would be no aid to Iran until a settlement of the oil issue had been made. Who would have drafted Eisenhower's reply? Would you have worked on it, or would it be at the NSC level, or someone in the White House?
I suppose I would have worked on it, but I don't remember.
Now,
is this when the argument was, how could we help you? How could the American people understand our giving you money at a time when you have great resources that you could turn into money? That's what
that's exactly the tenor of his letter.
Yeah. Yeah, I think probably I had a role in it. But.
So it suggests in some ways, his response suggests in some ways that the oil issue had great bearing upon his basic attitude towards Mossadegh.
Sure, yeah.
I have some questions about the development of the coup plans, which have come to light in Roosevelt's book and some of the articles I've given you. But since you've already answered them to some extent when you discussed your non-relationship to the principles involved in this, I guess I can ask you this though: what were your impressions of the political situation in Iran? Based on your reading of the cables coming back from coming back from Tehran, what was your reading or your impression of the political situation in Iran during the months before Mossadegh was overthrown?
Well, you're asking me to be pretty precise about something a long way ago.
Yeah.
My feeling is that, first of all, I and the men I worked with.
Well, I'm just afraid that it'll make noise up.
Had a complete confidence in.
Okay. It seems to be okay now.
Had complete confidence in Mr. Henderson and his staff in appraising the situation and in reporting on it. I think probably we felt that Mossadegh was losing the confidence of a lot of Iranians, but that's about as far as I can go now.
Okay. Now, from what I've read in Roosevelt's account and elsewhere, his first plan to overthrow Mossadegh failed when Mossadegh arrested Colonel Ansari, when he learned, or Mossadegh learned, that he was about to be arrested or overturned by Zahedi. And when his first coup plan failed, the Shah fled the country to Iraq, I think.
And then Rome,
that's right. Do you recall this turn of events? What your reaction was when you heard about this effort to oust Mossadegh?
No, I don't. I obviously was informed. That sort of thing I would have been informed of. Just a story. The poor ambassador, Iranian ambassador to Iraq, was a man who had been the chief protocol in court. And he had received instructions from Mossadegh not to meet the Shah. So he didn't meet the Shah. And I take it all back. The ambassador in Iraq was a man who did go out and meet the Shah despite his instructions. I can't remember his name now. And in Rome, the ambassador was the former chief protocol. And there, he didn't go out. But a young man who was an Iranian, just a very nice fellow, he went on out and he met the Shah. And of course, after the Shah returned to power, the fellow who had met him in Iraq, despite the Mossadegh's instructions, was given positions of great power and responsibility. And also, the little guy in Rome was jerked up to high roles in the court, at least very visible roles.
Huh.
Anyhow, it only proves that Ambassador never knows what's going to happen to him.
Huh. Now, when the first effort failed, CIA people regrouped, and there were efforts to work with their contacts in the bazaar and elsewhere to develop crowds that could take a role in moving against Mossadegh. I guess they worked with the military, let's say, General Zahedi and his people, and they were able to foment a successful coup, which led to the overthrow of Mossadegh. Did you get much after this had happened? Did you learn more about the CIA's role in this episode in the following months or year when you were at the desk?
It all opened up a good deal. Yeah. And also the CIA withdrew from at least visibly active involvement. What happened after the coup, after Mossadegh fell and the new government was formed, was an intense concentration on helping the new government to get established, giving the new government a chance to breathe and to, as I say, it was an instant supply of money, and giving the Shah support, and then also working on them to develop ways to get income from the oil. Now, I realize I seem to be describing the oil settlement in terms of providing income to the Iranians, and you, it seems to me, generally are suggesting that the Iranian oil settlement was a way of supplying profit to the oil companies. Both points of view are correct. But I do think the American government at that time was primarily concerned with supplying income to the Iranians.
As a basis for stability.
Yeah, and less concerned with making a deal for the oil companies. The two are inextricably connected, but if you have to give weight to one side or another, my recollection is that the weight ran more to, okay, Mossadegh's gone, there's a new government there, there's a new chance, let's help it work. And, of course, also they could pretty much push the British to the side. I mean, we were in the lead now.
Okay. I want to take a step back to this question of the coup and the CIA's role in the coup.
Yeah.
On the basis of the information that you were able to get at the desk in the following year or two, could you say how important the U.S. role was in the overthrow of Mossadegh? Was the U.S. role decisive or more incidental? How would you characterize that?
I've heard it described in a number of different ways by Mr. Henderson, by Kim, by others. I believe that its success is evidence that it was based on natural forces. There were broad forces which supported the idea of a more stable government, a government which could open up connections again to the West, and the Shah was popular. I do not think, however, that it would have happened then without outside instigation. And the two go together.
Okay. Now, a few months after the coup, Vice President Nixon met with the Shah in Iran during the course of a long trip Asia.
I'd forgotten that.
Did his visit have any special significance, political significance? The Vice President stopping to see the Shah during the course of a tour of the Near East and the Far East?
I don't remember that at all, but I think it's a good idea, and certainly the Shah must have gotten a good deal of self-esteem out of it.
That's sort of a show of political support by the U.S.
Oh, yeah. I mean, senior official, I mean, this can hardly be, other than the President's the only next one, in their eyes.
Okay. Now, a number of historians and analysts have argued that during the years after 53 into the early 60s, that the Shah and Iran were in sort of a tutelary relationship with the United States. A tutelary relationship with the United States. The U.S. was sort of like a he was sort of a tutor in terms of developing and running institutions. Sort of a somewhat subordinate relationship between the two countries. From your vantage point, the State Department, how true was that? That the U.S., that Iran was kind of a client state, or it was a sort of subordinate relationship with the United States.
I think the client state description is exaggerated.
Yeah, okay.
Both the best and the worst of American foreign policy involvement came to play here. The best is, of course, the generous, idealistic American attitude toward helping other people. The worst is the sense of assuming responsibility for whatever happens. In other words, the sparrow falls in the forest, it's our fault and our responsibility. The vast aid programs which developed in Iran, in a sardonic way, I would say that they had very little effect, except in one regard, which they were not proposing as an objective. What they did was they employed at management levels, middle management levels, young men and even some women who were educated and who were honest and who were thereby protected from the corrupting influences of regular Iranian society and Iranian government, and were allowed to grow and to develop, and also were given work toward idealistic objectives. I don't think of that as making Iran a client state at all. I think it may have developed, long after I'd left the desk, into false relationships between us and Iran. But while I was on the desk, our involvement with Iran was extraordinarily idealistic. It was a desire to help, and it was a desire, and we used, in the helping, we used these really good young people who otherwise might have been damaged or wasted. Am I sounding passionate? Anyhow, I feel that way.
Uh-huh.
I also think you have to be careful to divide the first years of the Shah's accession to power after the fall of Mossadegh from what happened later. It's a progression, and there's a connection, but the first years, there was no secret police of any significance. There was no serious repression that I knew of, at least, of political opponents. It was a halcyon period.
Okay. Now, one of the main goals of the State Department after the coup was to settle the petroleum dispute. And you mentioned earlier the basic goal was to provide around with income as a basis for a more stable political situation, and also a way to tie the oil companies into managing resources in a way that would provide income to both parties.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first step of this process were Anglo-American discussions during the fall of '53 that were designed to lead to sort of some kind of a settlement that would work for all parties concerned. Did you take part in any of these discussions?
Herbert Hoover Jr., as you know, was brought into play by Eisenhower. And Mr. Hoover was a man of great distinction in the oil community. He had a reputation for absolute probity. His firm, at least I was told the story, his firm was so trusted by the oil companies that two competing oil companies would both contract with him to perform surveys in the same general area. he was a man much affected by his own experience as the child of a prominent person. This caused him, among other things, to be deeply suspicious of anyone getting close to him, but at the same time, it meant that he could move easily in the world of power. He'd grown up in it, and he was used to it. I think he was probably a much better sort of single person moving as an independent consultant and working on individual things as a person than he was as an undersecretary of state, where he had to deal with a great organization. Anyhow, while I was desk officer, he was hired to be the catalyst and the leader of the American negotiations, which were successful in his point of view, and as far as I'm concerned, my point of view. Then he became Undersecretary of State, and one of the things he said which affected my life was when he got settled and the people who served the secretary and the undersecretary is called secretariat, and the administrative officer and the senior officer were there, and Mr. Hoover reported to have said, well, now, who are these people who are reading my mail and are around me? And I said, well, these are fine people, and they're, you know. Well, he said, I don't see anybody like, say, well, like John Stutzman. Of course, they didn't know who the hell I was. And the next thing I knew, I got a phone call from somebody, Jimmy Burns, saying, Jimmy Burns, not the old secretary, of course, saying, hey, Stutzman, listen, come on up and see me. So I did. And he said, we'd like to hire you for this. We'd like to have you transferred from the desk to the secretariat. Mr. Hoover is expressing interest in you. And I said, okay. And that was that. And I was shifted off the desk and put up in the secretariat. Now, I tell you all that partially because it amuses me how life is affected by things, but also to show you that Mr. Hoover and I worked closely together and I had a close involvement with him. Now, how involved was I in the negotiations? Well, I was as involved as a staff officer can be, with the additional responsibility of running the Iranian desk. Did I understand major world oil policy? The answer is no, certainly not. Did I spend a lot of time worrying about whether Texaco and Standard Oil of California were able to get together? Not at all. But I was present, as I told you, when this group of senior people were placed in a room after the Attorney General had cleared it. Brownell, was he the Attorney
That's
General?
Right, Herbert Brownell. Name.
Thank God right. These names come back. And I didn't travel with Mr. Hoover. He didn't take people with him. He was a very private person. But I carried his bag a great deal in Washington, going from here to there.
Was Frank Page of Standard Oil of New Jersey, I think, was involved in the discussions and so?
Perhaps.
Did you know?
I don't remember.
You don't remember him at all? Okay.
No, I mean, I don't.
Yeah. Did Roy Henderson play a role in the outcome?
Certainly, working from the Iranian, from the Tehran point of view. That's I don't right. remember Mr. Henderson being called back, compared to the records would show if he was, but my own feeling is that he ran the show in Tehran. He and Mr. Hoover got on very, very well, and indeed, Hoover had a hand in bringing Henderson. No, the timing would be off on that. Well, anyhow, he and Mr. Henderson got on very well. Hoover and Henderson.
Now, in terms of the issues, how difficult was it to convince the British to yield their preeminent position running Iranian oil through NIOC and accept a multinational consortium where they would only have a share? Was this a difficult problem?
Of course, yes. Yeah. And Hoover did a splendid job. Looking back, I would say that the main element, the main stick we had was the British government, which really overwhelmed the AIOC and forced the AIOC to come to terms.
I see.
The range of reasons for that range from the British diplomats who probably resented the old AIOC control over their policies in mm-hmm. Iran, to a very sensible realization that the oil company could not return to its old situation, and that the thing to do was to get the best you could out.
Okay. Interesting. Now, how was it, maybe you recall this, but how was it that the French and Dutch companies were also brought into the picture? The French company and Royal Dutch Shell also had a share in the consortium.
Well, clearly the reason was that the Iranians had to have less than 50% English. And the Dutch were brought in because Shell is a Dutch company, or was a Dutch company, but also the British influence was considerable within it.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
So that the Iranians, who, believe me, were never fooled by any of these things, the Iranians nevertheless clearly were willing to put across to their people the idea that the British had been reduced to less than 50%, whereas the English were able to say, well, okay, maybe, but in fact we have more than 50% of a hand in this. Now, I'm looking way back, and I haven't thought about these things in a long time, and I don't study the literature on it. But that's my reaction to how the Dutch were, and who else was
there? Also the French.
I don't remember the French being in it at all.
Yeah. They had a small percentage of the consortium.
I don't remember. Yeah.
Okay. Now, according to some declassified NSC documents from late 53 or late 54, the Department of Defense was taking the position that if the British did not come to a settlement with the land on the issues that we talked about, that the U.S. should act independently in Iran to reach a settlement on the oil question, ignore the British, basically. What problems would have led the Pentagon to take such a position? Does this ring a bell in any?
It doesn't ring any bell at all, and I find it very foolish. Herbert Hoover Jr. would no more have allowed that to happen than he would have flown out the window.
Of course it wasn't, but that was the Pentagon view, apparently. It was thrashed out on the NSC level. In early January 54, the Executive Secretary of the NSC, James Lay, Jr., the NSC Executive Secretary, he presented a report to the Council on U.S. policy towards Iran. This was called NSC 5402, and discussed issues such as economic and military aid to Iran, the oil settlement. Various parts are still sanitized, so I don't know what else to discuss. Part of the CIA role in the country, intelligence issues, I'm not sure. Mm. Were you a member of the working group that would have drafted this report to the Council?
I would have been, and I don't remember that particular paper, certainly not by number, but... Uh-huh. Many days I would spend sitting in the outside room of the NSC. The men I went with were Fraser Wilkins, and there was a redheaded Foreign Service officer, can't think of his name now, very good, very effective. Another man, in any case. And I would frequently be the first point for the development of a new paper. In other words, the request, the decision for a revised paper would start with a desk. That's typical, so I'm starting. As I say, I would many, many days go up. Now, the council discussion would always be on a staff. I never sat in on a discussion of the NSC itself, but it was on staff. The council discussions, as I remember, the staff discussions, would they, let's say, be working on a paper on China, and then they'd come to the paper on Iran, and then I'd be called in, and I'd sit behind the State Department principals, and frequently speak, and then I would be asked to leave, and they would deal with the CIA paper or something like that. So what I'm trying to describe to you is there was always a break-off at my level of of separate arguments. And then I have a feeling that there might well have been times when they bring in a specialist on the oil, maybe, or something, and whether I was there or not would not have anything to do with secrecy. It would have to do with whether I go on back about my business. Chances are I would stay. But if you ask me about a particular paper, the answer is I don't remember.
But you play a role in drafting them on a routine basis.
Routine, yes. Yeah. I mean, that's the basic way. And as I say, I distinctly remember day after day going with these fine officers from the policy planning group, and for that matter, before going, sitting down and working over the papers with them.
Were these the meetings of the Operations Coordinating Board, the OCB, that you would have been going to?
Yeah,
that was like a subgroup of the NSC, yeah. the technical level, I guess.
Yeah. Then I can also remember something. Yeah. I hadn't thought about this. At that time in the department, the UK desk, which had another name, I've forgotten, but anyhow, the director.
British Commonwealth Office.
British Commonwealth.
Northern European Affairs or something like that.
Hayden, was that his name? There was a man there who was almost notorious for his insistence on being involved in any policy paper, or for that matter, even instructions to the field, which related in almost any way to British interests. Well, of course, British interests were so extensive, so pervasive, that it meant that this guy was constantly getting in your hair on things that really were not of great consequence to the King or Queen of England. And so he was a thorn. I remember that. He was a problem in getting papers up to the Secretary or to the NSC in regard to Iran, because he took a sterner view of British interests in Iran than even the British government. That's an aside. But I do remember actively being involved in the development of policy papers, which went all the way up to the NSC.
Yeah. Okay. Now, according to one of the updates of this NSC report, it was updated periodically, I think on a quarterly basis, perhaps, every 3 or 4 months. According to one of the updates from April 54, which I've seen, Herbert Hoover Jr. and Roy Henderson were trying to educate, that's the word that's used in the document, trying to educate Iranian leaders as to the realities of the international oil business.
Yeah.
Do you know how they went about this educational mission that's briefly discussed in this document, but not really described?
My answer has to be no, I don't know specifically, not because I was cut out, but because I don't remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
But both of those men, whom I knew so well, their view of education always was to be persuasive. They were never patronizing, either of those men, to any Iranian or to other people. Both of them believed that successful negotiation depended on mutual trust and on honesty, the basic honesty. And I many times have been involved with both of those men when they would say, tell the other person things which showed up weaknesses on our side, or things that the other person should be concerned about dealing with us. You know, those things. Never, of course, betraying, but making clear that a proper settlement had to be based on understanding and trust. So I think that's what they mean by education.
Uh-huh.
But in terms of what papers or what techniques, or so, there wasn't anything covert about it, I'll assure you that.
No, that same month, April 54, the U.S. and the British began negotiations with the Iranians for the consortium plan. The talks were held in Tehran, I guess. Did you go to Tehran any time during this 54, 55? Did you return to the country for any meetings or discussions?
I did go as desk officer. I went back to Iran on at least one occasion, and I couldn't tell you the year, but it had nothing to do specifically with negotiations.
Yeah.
It was simply going back and working on the ground with people about a myriad of problems.
Uh-huh.
Boundtree was DCM then, I remember that.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And Henderson, of course, was ambassador.
Yeah. Okay. So Henderson and Hoover go to Tehran to meet with the Iranians to discuss the consortium question. Ali Amini was the head of the Iranian negotiating team.
Mm-hmm.
Had you met Amini in Tehran?
He was another member of the Qajar aristocracy, which had survived the Shah, had an abiding hatred of the Shah in terms of family relationships, but he was a very, very good representative of his country and very knowledgeable.
He became ambassador shortly after the consortium question was settled.
Did he?
I think, was this when you were still at the country desk? Do you recall? Now, apparently, during these negotiations, the Iranians from the Shah...
I think now that you mentioned... I do remember that Amini was eased out of the country, given an embassy, the way we occasionally do with people that the president doesn't want around, given an embassy to honor him and to move him the hell out of the country so that he wouldn't be there in the sort of carrying out of these of the settlement. I don't remember why. I don't remember if he was if they were concerned he would be an impediment, or concerned that
was too influential, perhaps,
that he would be a difficulty of any kind. Anyhow, I think that's why he was shipped out.
In any case, I think apparently the Iranians from the Shah, at the highest level down, did not like the consortium arrangement because it still left control of oil in the hands of foreign companies. Now, how difficult was it to convince the Shah and Amini as well to accept the consortium arrangement?
I don't think it was that difficult. They struggled, but Amini, I mean, the actual progress in the negotiations was, of course, difficult. But I don't think the Iranians thought they could do any more than get the best they could. I don't really think that the Shah or Amini or anybody else thought that they could get anything resembling a non-foreign control. They did, however, and you have to tell me if I'm correct, they did, however, get in that agreement some kind of understanding that it was a contract with a term.
I think you're right.
And after all, what's a couple of years, 10 years, 20, whatever it is, I've forgotten. And whereas the negotiation of the AILC agreement of, was it 33 or something, was going to hold them for another 50 years or something. So I think the Iranians were going for a settlement. They knew they had to get a settlement. Two, they were going for as much money as they could get, and three, they were going for a term. And they got it.
They changed the rules later on.
But I mean, the term, weren't the American companies literally going to be moved out after a period of time or something?
I'm not sure. It was left an open,
was
open,
it?
Sort of an open question.
But in any case, it was an open question. If at a minimum, it was not a conclusive. Anyway, that's my reaction looking back. I could be mistaken.
Now, shortly after the talks ended, the U.S. gave the Iranian government another grant in aid. I think it was sometime in the fall of 54, summer of 54, perhaps. I'm not sure. But to what extent did the U.S. link acquiescence in the consortium plan with additional assistance?
I have no idea. I don't know.
Okay. Now, one of the last issues to be settled was the extent, was the question of which U.S. companies would play a part in the consortium. The smaller companies, the independents, originally wanted, I guess, from what I read, a 33% share in the consortium, on the grounds that they had supported the boycott of Iranian oil for the most part, and they should be rewarded for their observation of the international boycott against Mossadegh oil. How much support did the independents have in the State Department? Did they have much sympathy? Was there much sympathy for their position at State? Or?
I don't remember. I just don't remember.
Apparently Ralph K. Davies played a major role in getting the independents.
Really?
Some share of the consortium. It was a minor share, but they got a share, like 4 or 5%, something like that.
Where was Jones? Alton Jones around here? Why am I so familiar with that name? Is he involved with this?
I'm not.
He was an independent, certainly.
Yeah, I think they might have had a share of the share. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But does, did you know Davies or had contact with them?
No.
You just know the name.
I know the name.
Now, after the consortium agreement was reached, later in 54, the Shah came to the United States for a state visit.
Mm-hmm.
He was with Eisenhower and Dulles, and among others. Well, what was your role in the preparations for this kind of a, for a state visit? What kind of a role did the country desk play?
Well, I'll answer it by telling you a story about when the Shah came, not incognito, but not on a state visit. And he and his new wife, the German girl, the Bakhtiari girl, that was her name. Can't think of her name. Beautiful woman. They came and they had a good time up in New York. He walked into it. He walked into it, one of those big car sales places up in near Columbus Circle. He's not a very impressive looking man in civilian clothes, and he had a rather shabby looking aide with him, and the salesman didn't even come over for a while. Then some salesman came over, and the Shah by this time had looked around the showroom enough to come to us, and he said, "I'd like that, but in a sort of an orange color. I'd like two of those." And then he got arrested speeding on the New Jersey Turnpike, and we had to fix that up. And then he came to Washington, and there were no particular plans. And so, of course, I was involved meeting him. And he said, "Well, I'd like to ride." So he and I rented some horses at down Rock Creek Park and went riding in Rock Creek. Christ, when I think about it today, the Shah of Iran and, you know, the terrorists and all that stuff. Here the two of us were just riding along in Rock Creek Park chatting with. And I took him dancing, my wife and the Shah and Soraya, that was her name. We went dancing in one of the big old hotels there, and just all I did was call up and got a table. I didn't tell the maitre d' who was going to be there. And Soraya dances very well, I'll tell you that. And it was all very cheerful. Then Kim Roosevelt got very upset because he felt that we ought to be doing more. And so he got Herbert Hoover Jr. to have a little soiree. When I think about it, it's all so pastoral, so halcyon.
A level of informality that went away just 20 years later.
Oh, my God, you know. Yeah. Now, as to the state visit, the formal visit, when you have a formal visit, the desk is involved in writing toasts and, of course, position papers. But the actual ceremonial stuff is handled by the protocol office and all of that. Mm-hmm. And I, frankly, I don't even remember it. I doubt very much if I was much involved. As I say, when he was there informally, he and I rode together and danced, you know. So when he was there formally, he was the Shah of Iran, and I doubt if the desk officer even got invited, except to a large throng or something like that.
Okay. Did you do much on the work in the military aid program?
No.
Like as
no.
Now, one thing that occurs to me, after the coup in 53, CIA worked closely with the Iranian military in an effort to, I guess the Tudor party had a fairly large presence in the Iranian Air Force and the Army. They had their own people working covertly in the armed forces of Iran. And the CIA worked with military intelligence in Iran to purge these people out of their positions. Did you know much about this effort?
No, I remember once getting a phone call from I suppose, the Air Force.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure. From one of the armed services, either Air or Army, saying that a couple of young officers on training in the United States, that information had turned up about them, and that the government of Iran wanted them returned promptly. And this Defense Department person said they felt they had to have a State Department clearance. And I said, "Ship them back," and hung up. And years later, somebody came to me and said, it was somebody in the State Department. He said, we always remember how clear and firm you were on that. I'd forgotten all about it, and how that sort of thing today would be bucked all the way up to the President of the United States, and the ACLU would get it. I said, well, I don't know. I thought it was a clear question, and I answered it, and that was the end of that. But nobody said to me, prove that they're Tudor or anything like that.
Yeah.
Maybe they were. Maybe they were just stealing money for all I know. Anyhow,
yeah. Huh.
That's about all I know. That's a long answer to your question. Yeah. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Now, you said earlier that at this stage, the Sabah had not been created. They weren't created until 57, I think. 57, 58.
So. They certainly, it was not a police state when I was involved.
Yeah. But do you know if there was any liaison between CIA and, say, Iranian military intelligence that would, a connection being formed that would have led to Sabah being created later in the 50s?
I really don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the first mission we had there was to the
Gendarmerie, yeah.
Which you can argue is a police force because it was concerned with internal controls. And we sent General Schwarzkopf there.
That's right.
And then they squeezed him out, and the Gendarmerie was still going when I was there, but then closed down. But I'm quite sure they were more in the role of highway policemen than they were of secret police. Perhaps it was tied into intelligence in the long run, but it was simply not a police state when I was involved with Iran.
Well, do I understand that some of the National Front politicians, like Fatemi, were executed at the onset of the coup? I mean, there was some repression.
Fatemi, that's not repression exactly, is it? I mean, Fatemi called for the death of the Shah, and I think when the Shah came back to power, he killed him. But Mossadegh was tucked away in his farm and kept under police control. Well, I don't think of that as being in the category of a police state controlling its population by police forces. I think the Shah killed, as far as I remember, only one man. He only killed Fatemi, didn't he? Did he kill others?
There might have been some executions of the one officer, those two officers that I mentioned earlier. But beyond that, I'm not sure.
But in terms of National Front, he certainly didn't molest Saleh or Mosse or Kashani. In fact, some of them remain in the Majlis. I don't know.
I think. I'm not sure. Now, in negotiations with the Soviet Union during 53 and 54, Zahedi and the Shah moved away from Mossadegh's policy of neutrality in terms of the Cold War. In negotiations with the Soviet Union, they refused to make concessions over issues such as the frontiers, territorial frontiers, and World War II debts. Now, according to the NSC paper that I've seen, Iran had taken a, quote, provocative, unquote, approach toward the Soviet Union in terms of taking a much more hard line on these questions of borders and war debts and so forth. To what extent did the State Department encourage the Zahedi to take a tougher position in these negotiations? Was there any encouragement at all?
I don't remember, but I can say that Loy Henderson, whose memoirs, you know, have recently been published, but they only deal with his experience in Russia.
That's right.
Loy Henderson was a very clear-eyed man when it came to the Soviet Union.